Okay, shall we begin? So I hope everyone did well on the test from Thursday. We have gotten the feedback on that. It looks like the average for the whole class is about 86, which is really good. So you can kind of gauge your own performance by that after you look at them when you get them back in discussion section. The other thing that I should say here is you have no idea how hard we work to make sure that all of the grading is absolutely uniform across all the TAs. So there is a very well-used system where we grade the objective parts of the exam and we look at how all of you performed relative to each other in the objective parts of the exam. And then we have the TAs calibrate their grading on the essays, which are, we understand, not objective. But to make sure that all of them are grading the same on their grading of the essays. So it's a pretty elaborate process, but I know that everyone always thinks, oh my God, Noah's my TA and he's a son of a bitch. And if I just had Katie, she's a sweetheart. And, you know, I'd be making a lot better grade if I had Katie for my TA. Not true. Absolutely not true. Katie's a son of a bitch. No, it's just, you know, it doesn't make any difference. Believe me, we go to great ends to make sure that that grading is uniform. So we're starting a new series of lectures here, as I described earlier in the semester. A third of the class at the beginning here has been on form in architecture, issues of form. And the second one-third is going to be on issues of physical considerations, and the third one-third will be on issues of human factors. And so we're transitioning from form to physical considerations. And actually, today's lecture is a kind of transitional lecture, as was the last lecture in the form series. They're sort of letting you know that these are not hard boundaries, that you can be thinking about form and physical considerations at the same time, and form certainly influences physical considerations. Physical considerations definitely influence form. But at the same time, we are able to see these as rather distinctive issues. So in physical considerations, we're going to be talking about all kinds of things that have to do with really physics, and physics and other physical forces in nature. Because buildings exist in a physical world, they're extremely tangible physical objects, and we have to worry about their structural integrity, their firmness, as Vitruvius would have said, and we have to worry about their how they're constructed and the materials they're made of and all of those kinds of things. Those are physical considerations. But it's also things like climate and energy performance. Those are physical considerations. How does the building exist in the physical world, and what kind of resources does it command, and what kind of depletion of the Earth's resources are implied by the building. So it's all sorts of issues having to do with water, with wind, with sun, with gravity, with materials, with energy, all of those kinds of issues. And in particular, there are five things that will come up over and over in this discussion. One of those things is, how does the building deal with issues of land? How are we consuming land? Because natural land, we know, has certain ecological principles. It is a habitat for certain species. It does good things for our greenhouse gas situation by the way plant materials interact with the environment. It also is a valuable resource for agriculture and for things like that. So issues of land are important. How does the building consume or not consume land? And what is its relationship to the land? We'll be dealing with that pretty thoroughly today, but that'll happen over and over. A second big issue is, how does the building deal with consumption of other natural resources besides land? Buildings are made of something. Did you use tropical hardwoods that depleted the rainforest? And in order to get that wood, you had to tear down some ecology very, very distant from the building. But in order to do that, you got building materials that had a detriment to ecology or to the natural environment. All building resources, cement, steel, glass, all of these things come from cement, comes from a resource we mine in the ground. And there's an extraction process, and there are resources that are depleted in the process of doing that. Steel, of course, is made of iron ore and coke, and there's coal involved. And so there's a process, an enormous amount of heat required to make iron ore into steel. So there's an energy consumption in that, and there's a multiplier effect. So that material one has to think about. What are the implications on the natural environment when I'm using that steel, or when I'm using that concrete, or when I'm using that glass, which, again, there's a process of manufacturing that. Another common building material, copper, things that make copper wires. Copper is also used in many other ways in buildings. The extraction process of copper is super toxic. In fact, although the United States has tons of copper resources, we don't actually get much building copper from the United States. Most of it comes from Chile, because our environmental protection laws make it so difficult to extract copper, because it's a toxic process, that in fact it just isn't done in the United States, and instead we're having that stupid toxic process for all those poor Chileans. Now that's not good news, but these are things we need to understand. The building process has big multiplier and effects on all kinds of building resources that we use. So the first thing we think about is what's the relationship to land. The second thing is what is the relationship to other building material resources. The third thing is, what is the implication on energy consumption? I mentioned in an earlier lecture that more than half of all of the energy consumption in the United States happens in buildings. We think of cars being this big consumer of energy. It's nothing compared to what buildings do. And it's completely invisible. We're sitting here right at this moment consuming energy in this building because there's an air conditioning system, because the high is going to be 94 degrees today, and because we want to be absolutely no more than 74 degrees sitting here in our creature comfort inside the lecture hall. And there is a mechanical system that is sucking up fossil fuel in order to give us that comfort level. And that happens invisibly in buildings all over all the time. And either they're very efficient or they're very inefficient in the way they deal with energy consumption. So a third big issue is energy consumption in buildings. And then there are a couple of other things that are also important to think about. One is, what do we do with waste in a building? There are many, many wastes produced by the building. Every time you go in and flush the toilet, that goes somewhere, and we have to dispose of that waste material. Also in the construction of buildings. Oh my gosh, you have to sort of be on a construction site to see the dumpsters full of waste material that are necessary when you construct a building. You don't use every bit of that piece of sheetrock. You cut it and make it fit, and then there's leftovers, and that gets sent to the landfill. Or when you're doing wood, there's leftovers, and that gets sent to the landfill. And these are either, again, you can be efficient in the use of those materials, or you can be wasteful in the use of those materials. And it often is the design of the building that is implying whether it's wasteful or it isn't wasteful. So waste is a fourth big issue. And then the fifth issue is toxicity. Because, again, sometimes building materials have off-gassing. All of these fabrics that we have these days in buildings, or carpets, they're almost all synthetic these days, and there's off-gassing. Indoor air quality has gotten to be a big, big issue in the United States. We have an astronomical increase in asthma. Probably a lot of you have asthma or have had asthma. Your generation has a hell of a lot more asthma than my generation. My generation had a hell of a lot more asthma than the prior generation. It's partly because we spend more time in buildings and because these materials, which are not so good for us, and because we have a closed system so we're not getting so much natural air in, there can be toxicity in some building materials. So again, when we're designing a building, are we thinking about making a really healthy environment, healthy air inside that building. Also, there are building materials that have turned out to be terribly toxic, like freaking asbestos. In the 1950s, everybody thought, miracle building material, it's fantastic. It's fireproof, it's inexpensive, it's durable. Yeah, the only downside is it gives you cancer. So then we have had to now remediate buildings, and we're constantly worrying about that. If you take a building that was built in the 40s, like this building was, there is going to be tiles in the bathroom, and there's going to be adhesives that have asbestos in them. And whenever we do anything to renovate that building, we've got to worry about, we don't want to release that asbestos into the air because it's a carcinogen. Okay, have I scared you enough about how many just possible pitfalls there are in terms of physical considerations, in terms of things we need to worry about if we want to make buildings that last, that are healthy, that are durable, that are good for the environment, that are energy efficient, that do what we need buildings to do in the very best sense. So for the next 5 lectures, we'll be dealing with these issues of physical considerations very thoroughly. And in this talk today, we're going to be dealing in particular with buildings and the land, kind of relationship between building and nature. And as I said, that last lecture in the series on form, the organic and natural sources of form, that was in a way leading into this. And the Twitter card question for that lecture asks you, how interested are you in organic sources of form versus mathematical sources of form? What is it in nature that may be sustaining in the larger design of buildings? Or is it really more the order and precision of mathematics and geometry that is more sustaining? And sometimes after a quiz, I just don't read these, but these were so good. I wanted to let you hear a few of your responses to that. And it'll be a good segue into us talking about really nature and land and buildings today. So someone says, I would make things 70% natural and 30% mathematical. I believe that if you're taking over land to erect a building, the architecture should pay homage to its original state and organic surroundings. The message being sent by a natural or organic building is stronger than strictly mathematical. However, math is still needed for stability and structure. Someone else says, I have quite a glutinous nature, and instantly I want 100% organic. But the organic, the sensual, the spectacular, is all the more so when it is a rarity and a sweet surprise. So fill the world with numbers, but around the corner or behind a peak, let the organic surprise you and be all the more refreshing. Someone else says, most of the time, math is scary and intimidating to me. It's cold and clear-cut with sharp edges. You either get it or you don't. I identify with the beauty of nature. It reminds me of my childhood and my future. I think too much of either is bad. You're either too logical or too emotionally based. That's why I would have 70% nature and 30% math. I'm only reading you the ones about nature. There were some people who did like math more, but this is better segue. Someone else says, I believe organic should get 70%, math 30%. I say so because organic shapes allow for more variability based on regional differences. Mathematical geometry is more universal and generic, and also less attuned to the local environment and landscape. That one's a really good one for what we're going to be talking about today. Someone else says, I went to Barcelona and loved all of Gaudí's work. Until today, I didn't know why. I'm a geography major, and nature is the most important thing to me. So I loved how Gaudí used the environment to inspire his work. I want 100% organic. Finally, someone says, I would be in heaven if the world was 95% organic. During this lecture, I was aghast by the beautiful stretching of the wood handles. I fell in love with the sloped walkway under the hill at Park Guay. And basically, my life goal now is to visit Casa Mila. Numbers and shapes are nowhere near as sensual and organic, though some kaleidoscope designs still intrigue me. So let's take maybe that notion, especially the notions that were in here about how organic things connect us to nature. And maybe there's something special about that kind of connection that we don't get in other kinds of forms in buildings. So today we're talking about buildings and land, and we're going to start by looking at a few examples that are ancient, amazing, beautiful examples of mankind living in harmony with nature. So all those things I was just talking about that were scary, these are examples of mankind living in nature over centuries in a way that was extremely respectful of the land, extremely respectful of natural resources, and very nurturing of human beings. So this is a series of little mountain villages in southern China. I went there with my son and his girlfriend, and we were hiking. And these villages you can't actually get to with an automobile. There are no roads in this part of southern China. It won't be long till there will be roads, but still in this area there are no roads. So you hike into these villages, and they've never had vehicles. In fact, they really don't use the wheel because it's so mountainous, the terrain is so irregular, that it's very difficult even for a cart or a wheelbarrow or something like that. But they have done a wonderful job of harnessing natural forms and natural processes for the benefit of their culture. So as you can see, it's very mountainous, but they have modestly terraced those mountains. And they're growing rice. Now, rice is it's an interesting crop because you have to have a flat area in order to flood the field. Because when you grow rice, you have to flood it and sprout the grass, the rice, and then after a while it can be drained. But it has to have water drowning it in the early process of growth. So they have these little terraces that they've done all the way up and down the mountains. And one of the things that does is by terracing it, it also reduces the erosion so that even when there's a big rain or something like that, they've made these modest little walls that slow down the velocity of the water as it goes down the hill and reduces erosion and at the same time allows them to grow this rice. Now you can see that the rice fields follow the shape of the contours of the hills exactly. They make a kind of contour map. We'll be looking at contour maps a little bit later. And then as you can see, then when they put their buildings in, they put them in along those contours as well, running long and thin parallel to the contours so that the buildings weave into the landscape just like the fields and the crops do. And they make their buildings out of the materials that are right there and available. So when they start to make a rice field, they'll cut down the trees that are on the site and they'll use those trees for the wood to make their houses. And they'll take the rocks out of the field because when you farm, you don't want a lot of rocks in there. And those rocks will be used for the foundations of their buildings. And so they make the buildings exactly out of the materials that are right there in nature. And they build primarily wooden structures. They're really good at it. These are pretty sophisticated wooden structures. And they do them without any nails because they don't have any tradition of metals. There's no mining of iron ore or anything like that. So when they put the wood together, they use what's called mortise and tenon joints, where you carve away a hole in one piece of wood and you make a tongue that sticks in from the other piece of wood, and it makes a really good firm structural joint there. So this is many cultures have used mortise and tenon joints. but they use it quite extremely in this case with very, very little other attachment, just wood to wood. Then their houses, which you see on the right here, are really fascinating. It actually is a combination of a barn and a house. So this is pretty high altitude. It's actually in southern China, so it's relatively near the equator. But the altitude is high enough that it's cold for many times of the year, actually. So when it's cold, they have to bring their animals, their cows and their pigs and their horses, donkeys, not horses, mostly. They bring them into a barn. And the barn is actually the lower floor of the house. So that little bit indented there, and then you see not very many windows, well, that's for all the farm animals. And when it's cold, the farm animals generate heat, and the heat from the farm animals rises and actually heats the home up above. So it's a way of using your animals to heat your house, and they don't need any kind of fossil fuel or other kind of fuel for the heating. And then in the upper portion, that's where they live. And then the very top of the house is actually where they store their grain. And that acts as insulation. The layers of rice that they put up there are insulation in the house. So they're using the natural forces of heat and cooling as a way of helping them to make their home temperate. So they build these beautiful houses out of wood, and they also make them very dense. The land is very, very precious. So you don't want to eat up too much of the land with sprawling villages or houses. Their villages are very, very compact. You can see even three stories, even though they're in the middle of nowhere. Why wouldn't they just make one-story houses and spread them all over the place like we freaking do in the United States, right? Land is cheap, sure. Eat as much of it as you want to. They understand, no, land is precious. And you don't eat up any more than you need to, so you make your villages very compact. They, of course, don't have any roads or highways or cars or fossil fuel generated by that. They mostly just go relatively small distances from village to village. And they have these rock paths that they've produced to do that. And they haul all of their goods either by human transport or by donkey transport, as you see on the left. And then they associate themselves together in these little villages that are very close-knit and often have had, you know, families live there for generation after generation after generation, and they have a nice little social life. As you can see, these ladies sitting there yammering away in the middle of the day in this little village. And then they collect into really quite sweet little central squares and neighborhoods in the villages. Of course, when their wooden houses go down to meet the ground, the wood would rot if you put it in the damp ground because dampness and wood don't go together. So instead, they take the rocks and they make the foundations for their houses out of the rocks they find in the fields. Very strange they turn them vertically, but that's just the way they started doing it, and over a long period of time, that tradition has stuck. So there you see those compact little villages in the slide on the left there. And, sorry, the slide on the right. And then this slide on the left is a very interesting emblem of three local villages here that cooperate with each other. And this is just a kind of an attitude that comes of, you know, living together and living with the land and protecting all of that and cooperating with each other. So they have one fish for each village. One, two, three fishes. But all three fishes end up having the same head and the same eye there. And that's the way they see themselves, all working together as one. And it's interesting that their emblem is then a fish, that natural resource of the area. Now, I'm not advocating that we all go back and live like these villagers in southern China. That is definitely not the point I'm trying to make. It would drive me batshit. It would be horrible to live in a village like that. Come on. I mean, that's not realistic. But there is something in the ethic of thinking of resources and understanding how processes can reinforce each other and how they can all be worked together for mutual benefit that is really inspiring in this place and something that is eminently applicable elsewhere. A second ancient example, and in that case, the architecture is not, you know, drop your jaw, pee in your pants, dramatic. It's lovely, I think. It's beautiful vernacular architecture. But I want to make the point that these issues can produce absolutely spectacular architecture. And an example of that would be Monte Alban in Oaxaca in Mexico. And this is way back in the 3rd to the 7th century, the first millennia. So it's ancient Zapotec culture in southern Mexico. And in this case, the Oaxaca Valley is just a beautiful, beautiful landscape experience. There are huge mountains all the way around this valley. And then there's this very flat valley that is surrounded by the mountains. And there is this one kind of odd piece where there's a peninsula that juts out into the valley. So the natural landscape made this very dramatic gesture of this peninsula of earth that's jutting out into the valley. And so the Zapotec Indians said, this is where we build our capital city. This is where we build our important monumental center of our culture. So on the top of that little spit, which we're seeing here, that's where they built their city. And that's what it looked like, this sort of tongue going vertically there into the valley, and on the right you can see it protruding into the valley there. And just as they could see the drama of that valley, the flat valley with mountains all the way around it, on this spit of land, they also recreated kind of mountains all the way around the periphery of that spit of land. And each of these became pyramids. So they built a series of pyramids. You can see them here and here, here and here. You can see them there, marked there, there and there, and there and there, and there and there. So just as there are mountains around the valley, so they're inspired by nature to build the same kind of forms, these pyramids around the center. And then in the very middle of that composition, this little spine there, that's the most sacred buildings. And they are, in a way, standing for the peninsula that sticks out in the middle of the Oaxaca Valley. So inspired by those forms they saw in nature, they made this incredibly dramatic and beautiful architecture. And these, still today, the pyramids blow you away. They're just really, even though not in great condition, some of them, they look absolutely beautiful. They're stunning objects. They were all drawn from a kind of synergy with nature in that place. On the right is a ball court. There again, where they actually, for a while, they would play their games in a space between two hills, and then they begin to make that architecture, and it turns into an important architectural form, as you see on the right. So, again, you know, you can actually take these forces of a local environment, you can understand them, work with them, and generate incredibly dramatic and beautiful architecture from that. A third example, and again, I'm sort of sticking here with America because this is, it's really interesting to me. Often we don't think of the United States especially as having ancient architecture, which is baloney. There were beautiful buildings being built here in ancient periods by Native Americans that were here long before the colonial influx of people came in. So long before we had pilgrims with their funny little buckled shoes and quirky hats, there were, Indian cultures that were in Acoma in New Mexico, and others, Chaco Canyon, Canyon de Chelly. There are a number of these sites in New Mexico where they're building very much in synergy with the land. So in this area around Acoma, it's desert. It's flat, flat, flat for as long as you can see. But then there are these dramatic mesas that pop up in the landscape. And the slide on the right just at the right-hand edge of it. You can see that mesa popping up there, and it's just like this mesa that's here in the foreground, which is where Acoma is located. So we see the city of Acoma sitting on top of that mesa that just jumps out of the flat ground. And there's only one little way you can go up there, so they're immediately a fortified city. Nature has given them the fortification so that they can protect themselves against their enemies. And then when they start to build buildings, they build them in the same way nature built buildings. Prior to building, they would live in caves. And the caves, they understood, when it's hotter than hell, and it gets super hot in the desert in New Mexico. When it's hot out there, you want to be in the cave where there's all this high thermal mass of the stone. And when you get in there, it's cool and it's comfortable. So when I start to build my house, I will take what's here available, which is dirt, basically. They take the dirt, they mix it with water, they make mud bricks. They use the sun to dry those mud bricks. They make those mud bricks into adobe walls. They make big, thick adobe walls, like the massive weight of the stone around the cave. And then when you go inside this building, it's got that coolness that you feel when you're inside a stone cave, but now man-made. And so the form of it is very much like the flat plain with the mesa jumping out of it. The material is very like, it's just the dirt and the soil that's there in the desert. The dealing with the temperature, they do it in exactly the same way they had seen nature give them comfortable areas in caves. The other thing they would do is understand that there are some times when you need the protection of those big, thick walls, but sometimes you actually want to catch every single breeze. So some nights, it might be very pleasant outside, but honestly, after the sun's been baking down on those adobe walls all day long, then it starts to saturate into the building at night. And so they have roof terraces on the top and these ladders that go up, and often at night they would simply sleep on the roof and catch every breeze available. So again, they're using the materials, the climate, the landscape to tell them how to build and what architecture should look like and be like. This is their primary church in Acoma, San Estefan. And again, it's an amazing replica of the natural form of a mesa. There's these big, heavy walls, even the kind of articulation of those towers, like the kind of vertical lines you see in the mesas as they crop out of the desert. So buildings and land working very compatibly, very efficient use of resources, very simpatico with the climate. So just again to say, okay, well, that's not just Native Americans in these or primitive societies, let's say, in backwater places. But these are also attitudes that can be transferred into very, very sophisticated cultures and architecture. And here's an example, and I pulled this one because this is exactly the same period of time as Acoma Sky City was being done in New Mexico, at the same time Mont-Saint-Michel was being built in France. And there the people were using very much the same attitude toward the land. So in this case, they had the flat, flat coastal plains on the west coast of France, on the Atlantic Ocean. And mostly they're just like sea marshes, super, super flat. But then just one spot, there is this enormous rock that protrudes out of that coastal plain. Complete anomaly to the geography of the area. And so way back in the 12th century, there were Catholic priests who came through this area. And they said, wow, God did something really special right here. This is a more sacred place because look how different God made this thing. So they built a monastery on the top of that hill. No reason for a monastery except the natural form seemed to them sacred, so they occupied. And then from the 12th century to the 16th century, they added a convent and they added a big church and a pilgrimage site, and out of that you began to be to get the entire sort of ensemble that we call Mont Saint-Michel now, which is like a little village that sits on top of this rock. That village would not have been there if it were not for the natural form. That's what attracted some kind of celebration of that form. And then every single move they made was about reiterating the quality of the landscape there. And it's really quite beautiful. You can see how this sort of outcropping of rock here turns into that line in the building. Outcropping of rock here turns into that line of the building. So it's just kind of a slow bleed from natural to man-made. And it's always about moving up the mountain and this ascension. And every gesture when you're in there is about climbing and getting to the top or descending and going to the bottom. And even the shapes and forms of all the buildings with this very strong verticality. And then when you're at the top, you're rewarded by seeming like you're absolutely on top of the world. And this is something that also, that feeling is there in Oaxaca in Monte Alban. It's there in Acoma Sky City, but that notion of being at the top and being able to survey the land around. And in this case, because it's so flat forever, you really get this sense of dominance over the land, of somehow being in the heavens with God up there at the top of Mont Saint-Michel. And even in detail, the way the buildings are built, they look like a rock cliff. They have that kind of vertical articulation like you would see in nature. And it's inspiring to the architecture. So the point here is that there is a way of looking at buildings and land, not just as an aesthetic device, not just as a way of saying, that makes me feel sensual and emotional and inspired by nature, but also as a technical device for utilizing resources that are right there by utilizing the climate, seeing how nature deals with the climate, how can man deal with the climate, so that it's a way of really being wholly engaged with natural forces. So we're going to be looking at three buildings for the next few minutes here. And these three buildings are they're in very, very different physical environments. And they're very, very different buildings. And it's to make the point that and someone said it in their Twitter card response last time, that one thing they liked about natural sources of form is it tends to make something more regionally expressive, more like its local culture or place, not just anonymous, generic, whatever, wherever, but something that really roots itself in a place. And in all three of these, we have buildings that are very rooted in their region, in their site, in their locale, and they come really out of that land. And they do it not just as an aesthetic device, but they do it as a performative device as well, a way of dealing with climate, with water, with wind, with soils, with gravity, with all of those issues. So the first example here is a house called Falling Water. It was designed by Frank Lloyd Wright. It is Wright's most famous building. And in, I guess, 1976, when it was the bicentennial of the United States, they had a big poll of architects all over the United States, and they asked what are the most important buildings of the first 200 years of U.S. history? What are the 100 most important buildings? And I will tell you that Battle Hall was number 100. Isn't that cool? So right here on the campus, we had one of those. Number 100 was Battle Hall. But number one was Falling Water. That was considered to be the best piece of architecture in the United States in the first 200 years of its existence. And it's just a freaking house. It's not even a very big house. But let me tell you the story of Falling Water. So there was a family, the Kaufmans, Mr. Kaufman was a very successful businessman. He owned Kaufman's Department Store in Pittsburgh, which was a very successful enterprise, but also an extremely high fashion place. So we think of Pittsburgh in a totally different way back then than now. This was in the 1930s, and it was a big steel boom period, and so the Mellons and the Carnegies, all these big steel families, they all lived in Pittsburgh. There was tons of money being made there. Think of it as Silicon Valley for the steel industry in the 1930s. Tons of money there. And all these people who were basically business people, kind of blue collar, rose through the ranks to become successful business people, they were trying to get good taste. And Kaufman's was the department store where they could get good taste. They could buy their furniture and their clothes and their everything they needed there. And the Kaufmans themselves were the arbiters of good taste in Pittsburgh. So Mr. Kaufman had, he and his wife had one kid, Edgar Kaufman Jr., and they wanted at a certain point to be able to get out of the city and have a frolic in nature periodically. So they bought a piece of land outside of Pittsburgh, maybe an hour and a half drive outside the city. And the terrain around Pittsburgh is really beautiful. It's hilly. It's got deep forest. And so they bought this beautiful piece of land. It had a nice little creek that ran through it. They would go out and, sunbathe and swim. And it was, they could just go out there, spend a Saturday there, and go back into the city. And occasionally, Edgar Kaufman would have some of his employees out, maybe have a picnic or a party out at this land. So they enjoyed it that way for quite a while. And then they decided, well, we'd like to be able to spend the night and in more than a tent. So we want to make a house that we could live in, not 100% of the time, but when we want to go out there outside the city. So given the fact they were people of great erudite good taste, they had to have the best architect they could find. And so they identified Frank Lloyd Wright, who was at the peak of his career. This guy was, he was just doing the best work of his life. He was about 60 years old. And so they hired Frank Lloyd Wright to be their architect. And this is just a wonderful story about the relationship between Wright and the Kaufmans. Frank Lloyd Wright did several other projects for them as well, and they did several other projects with really good architects in the era. But Frank Lloyd Wright goes out to the site, and he surveys it, and he talks with the Kaufmans and figure out what they need, and so he's ready to start designing the house. He lives in Spring Green, Wisconsin, so he goes back to Wisconsin to start working on the house. And Edgar Kaufman doesn't hear anything for a few months. He wonders how progress is going. So he calls up Frank Lloyd Wright and he said, I'm going to be in Chicago tomorrow. And Chicago's not far from Spring Green. It's maybe a 3 or 4 hour drive. He said, I'm going to, be in Chicago and I will just drive up and maybe have lunch with you and look at the progress on the house. And then I'll drive back to Chicago. And so Frank said, absolutely, Edgar, that's great. That's fantastic. We'll look forward to seeing you tomorrow. And all of his lieutenants who worked for him in the office were like freaked out. Nothing had been done on this house. Zero. Nada. Not one scratch on a piece of paper. And the client's coming tomorrow morning, and we're supposed to show him something? So they're totally freaked out. But not Frank Lloyd Wright. So he sits down for a little while, and he sketches out this house. And then he gives it to one of his lieutenants and says, okay, well, make some nicer drawings of this and put it together and do some elevations and a plan. And so then, by then they've just got the morning to do it, and his lieutenants are scurrying away working on that. Edgar Kaufman comes and Frank Lloyd Wright greets him, and they chit-chat for a little while. They have a nice lunch, and by about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, he takes him into the studio, and his worker bees, just finished, and he shows Edgar Kaufman the plans for the house, and they're almost exactly what was built. I mean, it's a dead ringer. It was all nailed down. Now, that story is sometimes told to express what a genius Frank Lloyd Wright was. Just this genius. It all just flows out of his hand onto a napkin sketch, and you have genius. But that's not what that says to me. It's not what that says to me at all. What it says to me is that design doesn't happen on a piece of paper. Design happens in your head. And Frank Lloyd Wright had been thinking about this house for months. And that house was being built and lived in and experienced in his head. And the difficult thing in designing the house was imagining it in his head. But then when Edgar Kaufman called, he didn't have any worries about that. It was all in his head. All he had to do was just describe it to someone else in a sketch and let them draw it up so they could see it more thoroughly. But it was designed in his head. And I totally believe that. For those of you who are architecture students, you know, sitting there scratching this and that and this and that and this and that, if you're not designing it in your head, it ain't going to be very good. It's a mental process. It is not a physical process. So, Frank Lloyd Wright designed this house, and let me describe to you how he thought through that process. So this is basically the site around this piece of land that the Kaufmans had purchased. It's heavily wooded, as you can see on the left. It also is a very interesting geological area where there were plate shifts over time. This would have been ancient plate shifts. But what happens is you'll have sedimentary stone, limestone, and so it's layered like this. And as there were shifts, tectonic shifts, then you tend to get these layers that are split, and then another layer, and then split, and then another layer. So you get these ledges that happen in the landscape. So there are these horizontal ledges, and there are these vertical trees. And there you can see one of those horizontal ledges where as the creek comes down here, it hits one of those shifts, and you get that horizontal line of the sedimentary stone, and the water's falling over it, and then there'll be a little farther another line of that sedimentary stone. In a way, it's terraced, like we saw that Chinese example at the very beginning of the lecture. So this is a drawing that had been done by Frank Lloyd Wright when he was out on the site, actually done afterwards in the office, but from notes and from a survey that he had gotten of the site. And this is a contour drawing where each of those lines is like if at every foot you took a slice through the ground, and then where you that hit the ground, you made a contour line. So it means that where the lines are closer together, that means it's steep, and where the line, like right through here, and where the lines are farther apart, up on the right here, that's where it's flat. So he's got this contour drawing. They're also citing every tree, just exactly where all the trees are, and the size of those trees. And there's this little creek called Bear Run. It comes down here. There is a waterfall right there. That's where one of those shifts occurs. Then it's flat again. Then there's another waterfall here where a shift occurs, and it's flat again. This is an outcropping of a fairly flat rock right there that's right on the edge of the creek. And it was at that fairly flat rock when Frank Lloyd Wright was out there. That was an area where the Kaufmans liked to sunbathe. That's just when there was no house there. They spent a lot of time picnicking and sunbathing right there. And Frank Lloyd Wright said, "You were right. This is the coolest place here. This is where we're going to put the house." Right on that rock. So he's imagining in his head the landscape and the qualities of the landscape and how the house will fit into that. And that's exactly how the house sits today. You see it as these horizontal layers of stone in the landscape, and he puts horizontal layers of the house in the landscape, and then they're the verticals of the trees in the landscape. And there are contrasting verticals in the house. And he didn't, like, clear out a bunch of trees and say, okay, here we're going to put the big lawn, and, and the big grand approach. Nope. Although that was absolutely, if you were making a rich person's house, you would freaking take out the trees so people can see that house when they're coming up to it. And you'd make that big green lawn so people knew, these people have money. This is a fancy, expensive house. He's got exactly the opposite attitude. What's important here is nature. What's not important here is showing how much money the Kaufmans have. So you wind through the site on the little road. When you get to the house, it has dodged every tree around it so that it's modestly nestled into the site. And it virtually disappears on the site. On the left, you can see how as the hill tumbles down, the house also tumbles down the hill. And just as the hill is stepped as it moves down, so the house is also stepped as it moves down the hill. And that plan on the left, I want you to think in your head of the plan of the Villa Rotunda by Palladio, which you had to identify as one of your slide ID questions. And I didn't show a picture of that house. I showed a plan of that house because that's what we talked about, the geometry of that plan. And what was telling that house what to be was the square and the circle and all those mathematical proportions. This is 180 degrees the opposite. Look at the plan of that house. It looks like a doodle. I mean, there is nothing beautiful about that plan. It's just a few funny little walls on paper. And the thing that is making that shape is not some abstract geometry or some beautiful shape in plan. It's moving when the ground moves, moving when the rock moves, moving to dodge a tree, moving to accommodate the water going through this area. It is physical considerations that are making this plan the shape it is. And that's why graphically it doesn't look particularly strong in that slide on the left. In the slide on the right, we see a section through the building as it's stepping down the hill and as it's reflecting the shape of the landscape as it moves down toward the creek. And the rooms are then tucked into those shelves of space that are created as that stepping occurs. The approach to the house on the left, you go up this winding path through the woods. And then when you come up to the house, you don't even see the house at all. In fact, there's a rock outcropping on the right and a rock outcropping on the left. And you drive between those two rock outcroppings. And the house goes over that. And that makes the porte-cochere for you to get out of the car and get into the front door right there. Extremely modest entry that really is more nature than it is Frank Lloyd Wright at that point. On the other side, we have this very clear articulation of what's in the landscape. The big horizontal shelves, a flat part, a horizontal shelf, a flat part, and then man-made horizontal shelf, a flat part, horizontal shelf, a flat part. It's just as if Frank Lloyd Wright were completing a series of steps that were made by nature first and then reiterated and completed by Frank Lloyd Wright in the building. Also, there are materials that are very like the area around. This limestone would have come from the site. And in fact, the configuration of it is exactly like it is in the site. I took that picture maybe 200 yards from the house. There is this cliff, and you can see this is sedimentary soil, and you're seeing those horizontal layers in a kind of craggy, rugged form, and that's exactly how Frank Lloyd Wright layered up that stone. It was quarried in horizontal planks and then laid up to be just like the natural form adjacent to it in the landscape. And just as the light in the forest is created by dappled light coming in between the trees. So Frank Lloyd Wright made at the edge of the building, he made these trellises that came out. He grew vines up on the trellises so that that dappled light was there all around the house and even in the house as well. So it is the materials of the immediate landscape. It's the colors of the immediate landscape. It's the textures of the immediate landscape. It's the light quality of the immediate landscape. Everything in the land is being translated into characteristics in the building. Now, this is the money shot of Falling Water. And this actually is, it's a spot where they often had a picnic. So there was a little trail through the woods where they would take their woodland walks. And this is, you just walk along that trail and there's a little picnic area that they developed. And you look back at the house and you see the horizontal planks of the landscape and the creek with the falling water that's terracing down that. And then you see the building extending that up beyond. But one of the things that's just amazing to me is that I took the slide on the right when I was there one time in the summertime. And I thought, this could not look better. This is just, I don't know, there's something in the way that the terraces of the gray limestone then get reflected in the terraces of the house, and it just seems like it grew right out of the ground. Then I was there one time in late fall, and the leaves had all changed. It was absolutely gorgeous, oranges and reds, and beautiful leaves, and somehow the house changed. It wasn't gray anymore. Now it was more honey-colored and seemed, you know, so much just perfect in the fall when the leaves were that color. And then I had an occasion to go there in the dead of winter. And this was hard because it's closed. You can't get in. But I knew someone. And they got me into it in the dead of winter. And wow, it looks just perfect in the winter. It's like the house could change with the season. So as the weather changed, as the light changed, as the vegetation changed, the house was changing in the seasons with it. Just a kind of spectacular coordination between the house and the landscape. And this is true inside the house as well. You see the glass detail in the slide on the left, where instead of having a post at the corner, instead the glass just slips around that corner, just magically, so that your view of nature is uninterrupted. You feel absolutely like you're outside. Even in the slide on the right, that little top window, which is open right there, it's an L-shaped window that pivots on one side so that when you open the windows, the whole corner of the house is gone. The corner, which is where you expect a building to be the strongest, that's where it opens up and says, no, no, no. This is all about connecting to nature. So everywhere, there's this sleight of hand where the inside and the outside bleed together so that he just runs the glass right into the mortar joints of the stone in the slide on the left. And that's the same detail you see on the right. So your eye just goes inside, outside with no barriers in between. So you remember that flat rock where he decided to site the house, in which the Kaufmans did a lot of sunbathing on that rock? That rock turns into the hearth for the fireplace. So that actually is the rock right there. And they built the house around it, and that became the kind of center of the house on the inside and the hearth for the fireplace. And again, when you're inside, there's something very natural, very warm, a feeling of being close to the landscape and natural colors that he saw in the fall in nature with the oranges and the yellows, as well as, of course, the limestone color. So this is a thorough job of someone looking at the land and saying, how can the building be an extension of the land, an extension of it physically as well as aesthetically? A second example. This one is a completely different environment. This one is on the coast of California, this very, very beautiful coastline of California on the Pacific Ocean. This area is north of San Francisco. A big development company bought hundreds of acres of land, and they were making a community out of that. We'll be talking, actually next time, a little about the land development process here. But what we're talking about this time is just one building that was built in this landscape. And it's a condominium building. And this is it right there, which you can see sort of blending into the landscape there. And you can see on the here, about the only thing that was out there at the time were these barns. And there were a few old barns that actually seemed to blend in very well. And then the condominium building is right over here and again blends in very well. So this is rugged, rugged coastline of California. High winds. It's very beautiful, but you get out there and it almost knocks you on your ass. The wind is so strong. So part of it was to make a building that could withstand that wind, that was tough and rugged. Again, physical considerations. How do we deal with this wind that's there? So all of the corners are clipped. There aren't eaves. There aren't overhangs, because that could, you know, cause a turbulence in the wind and be destructive. Even the textures, everything is tough and rugged, because that's what that landscape is like. It's also built around a courtyard, which then protects you from the wind so that you can get the views, but you're not getting the full force of the wind. When you approach it, you approach from high, and it's very, very subtle. You almost can't see the building. It nestles down below. It's also backed into some Monterey cedar trees that were pre-existing there. Very, very subtle as you approach it. But then on the other side, as Charles Moore, one of the architects of this, he liked to refer to it as a big wooden rock. So the texture and articulation of the rocks is re-expressed in the texture and articulation of the condominium building. But now it's a big wooden rock. And then it's built around this courtyard, which protects you from the wind. And gives you a space where then you can look out and see those views, but now without being knocked on your ass by the wind. It also, again, physical considerations. How is it built? It's built sturdy and tough and rugged. Big pieces of wood, not skinny little, you know, 2x4s. This is massive big pieces of wood. Very much like that barn, which is the slide on the left is the interior of that barn. That's just down the coastline that would have been a 19th century structure. And it's using, and then on the right, this is Sea Ranch, these condominiums, while they were under construction, made of these big pieces of timber. And that's because right adjacent there is huge redwood forest. So abundant wood and that heavy timber was very natural to get from that area. And on the right, you see a framing of all those big, heavy timber pieces. And then when you're inside, it has that same feeling of, you know, why in the world would you want to go up to this very memorable landscape and feel like you're in a freaking apartment in San Francisco with normal little rooms, layout, 3 bedrooms, 2 baths, living room, dining room, kitchen. I mean, that doesn't give you a sense of being in this place. The idea was that even when you're inside, you get a feeling of what the land is like, which is big open spaces. So inside it's big open spaces framed by these heavy timbers. And then the articulation of rooms, like this little tower has the kitchen in the bottom of it and a little, what they called a four-poster, a little bed space up above that you take a ladder up to. But it's got a feeling of being in this big open coastal landscape. And a tough, rugged landscape. There you are in that little bed space looking down on the larger area down below. Everything in the building, texture, space, shape, color, light, all of it comes from an appreciation of the land. So, very different building from Falling Water because it was a very different landscape. A third example, and this one we're going back to Frank Lloyd Wright again. And this was done by Frank Lloyd Wright at exactly the same time he was doing Falling Water. It went on for a good many years later because he did additions to it over time. It actually is his own home and studio in Arizona. So at a certain point, he's in his 60s. He's beginning to get some respiratory problems. That cold winter in Wisconsin is just killing him. So his doctors say you need to go somewhere in the wintertime where it's warmer. So at first, he buys this piece of land in Arizona, just outside Phoenix, and he camps on the land. So they would move their whole, his whole office and his family would move down from Wisconsin down to Arizona, and they would spend the winter there in Arizona. And they did that for several years, and then they finally decided that it's, you know, we need to build a place we can spend the winter here instead of doing it in tents. But by then he knew the site, and he knew the climate, and he knew the area extremely well. So in the desert, there are two ways that people have traditionally built. One is that they would do dugouts. You dig into the ground, and you get that thermal stability and coolness of the ground, just like the caves were for ancient dwellers in that area, like at Acoma. But you would dig into the ground. So that was one way to deal with it. Or the other way was to build tents, where you catch every breeze, and you just put shade above you, so you protect from the sun, but then you catch every breeze. And really, Taliesin is just a combination of those two things. Sometimes it's dugouts, where he digs into the ground, and the building, actually the roof, comes right down the ground because you're buried in the ground a fair amount. And there's a whole kind of, you know, stepping down to a kind of subterranean level that takes you out of the hotness and the aridness of the desert and then pulls you into a kind of oasis or landscape a little below. And then the other thing he does is he builds tents. And literally, they were tents made out of canvas originally. Later, he changed it to fiberglass, but where it's very light, airy structures that catch every breeze and just give you shade. So he takes actually the stones from the landscape around and he builds these dugout spaces. So he's making it again from the local materials. He puts them together in a very unusual way. They built this themselves, he and his employees. So they built formwork, they laid the big stones in the formwork, then they poured concrete around it so that it made a wall that you could see the stone, but it also kind of was a concrete wall, but a heavy masonry wall that would have that high thermal mass like a cave would have, and it dug down into the ground. And then in other places, it's this light, thin material that just provides shade and catches all the breezes. He also is on this flat desert, so the house kind of sprawls out and again catches every breeze by being open. And there you get that sense of it on the inside, sometimes a cave, sometimes with this tent-like quality up above. Now, there are people who would say, oh yeah, Frank Lloyd Wright, he did things in his own style. He had his signature. That's a Frank Lloyd Wright building. And I want to make the argument here that that is actually not what Frank Lloyd Wright did. Frank Lloyd Wright wasn't this, you know, let's do it my way, let's, you know, do it like I always do it. He was always listening and looking and thinking what the landscape told him. So at Falling Water, you get one kind of building and a very different kind of building at Taliesin. And they came from, in each case, this sensitivity to the land. So your Twitter card question today, and by now you must almost be able to anticipate, but I want you to think of some building you might have seen or experienced where there is a real conjunction of the building and the land, where it seems like the building really fits in that spot. And now don't just think aesthetically, but climatically or materials or other kinds of physical considerations. Have you experienced a building that really responds to its place and its climate and its land and its landscape? Or if you can't think of one that's really good that way, think of one that is crap, that just really violates the place where it is and seems so alien and so out of place and so wrong, and describe that one. So talk about a building that emanates sincerely from the land, or if you can't think of that, find us one that is not sympathetic to the land.